The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's great to be back. I think that all writers eventually want to go back to the place where they came from. In this case, it was for me to go back to Memphis, Tennessee, where I grew up, where I was born, to try to understand this pivotal moment in American history, and to try to understand and sort of deconstruct the most controversial, the most tragic, the most, in many ways, complicated event in my city's history. My father was a law professor and a lawyer at a law firm there in Memphis that had represented the garbage workers and represented King when he came on behalf of the garbage workers. And so I got a lot from him about this event. But, you know, you're always sifting your memory of things. You wonder, was the family lore correct? Did you hear the story correctly? You were always wanting to test your memories against the hard, cold documents. But, you know, coming back to Memphis was also the idea of coming back to the place where I came from in terms of literature. The first writer that I ever met growing up in Memphis was the great Civil War historian from the Ken Burns documentary. You may remember him, Shelby Foote, the guy with the beard and the pipe. He looked like a writer. He talked like a writer. He smelled like a writer. He was straight out of Central Casting. And he really gave me some very interesting ideas early on in life about what narrative history can be and what it can aspire to be. He, of course, came to history kind of through the back door. He was a novelist from the Mississippi Delta and came to it late in life with the idea of trying to make history alive on the page. He thought history could be deadly dull, the way it was often written in academic situations, academic settings. And that's certainly what I found when I went off to college. I went to Yale. I studied history, one of the great heavyweight departments, wonderful historians, wonderful writers. But it could be deadly dull. I don't really remember the word pleasure, like, ever being used, like, ever, to describe how, you know, reading a history text could be. It was supposed to be, you know, like, we were historians. Historians are people who put on robes, and we were arch-druids, basically, and we go commune with dead people who can't talk back. And this is very deadly serious business. So it took me a while, you know, to go out into the world and to learn how to write stories as a journalist before I began to see that and began to read people like Shelby Foote and Barbara Tuchman and some of the great narrative historians to see, you know, that there's another way to skin this cat. Shelby Foote, though, you know, the reason I know Shelby Foote is that his son, Huggy, the names are a little strange in the Deep South. Huggy and I were in a rock band together, and it was called Argus. And we basically did everything we could possibly do to prevent Shelby Foote from finishing his 6,000-page trilogy of the Civil War. You know, we were cranking up the Jimi Hendrix and the Pink Floyd, and there may or may not have been smoke in the room. I'm not at liberty to say, but we certainly were having a good time when Huggy would be lapsed in some sort of feedback reverie, and Shelby would knock on the door and say, Huggy, turn that racket down. I'm working on Appomattox. And we're like, right, sure. Of course, he was working on Appomattox, and he was working on this amazing 6,000-page trilogy, which took many years for me to understand and absorb. And so coming back to Memphis, I mean, Memphis is just this extraordinary city perched on the racial fault line. It's the capital of cotton. It's the capital of the Mississippi Delta. It's the capital of rock and roll and blues. And of course, Beale Street is there. Of course, Elvis got his start there. But it's also a place, you know, it's the, one of the very few cities of any size in America that's named after an African capital with all this heavy Egyptian mythology around it. So it seemed, as I grew up and began to think about the King assassination, it seemed almost scripted by fate that King would be killed there. You know, this is a man who traveled nonstop for over a decade. He could have been killed in Anaheim. He could have been killed in Akron, Ohio. He was killed in Memphis, the capital of the blues. So I began to kind of think about that. I began to think about how do I make a book here that is in which Memphis is a character, in which you begin to understand the confluence of things that brought King to Memphis, the garbage strike being the most obvious one, but the whole background, the whole backdrop of Memphis. He had come to Memphis really because he was beginning to recruit for this very ambitious and very controversial campaign called the Poor People's Campaign. In Washington, the idea was to take thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of poor people, African Americans, but also from other backgrounds, to Washington and to build this shanty town on the Mall to protest multi-generational poverty, systemic poverty. It was a very controversial plan. He was getting a lot of criticism, and of course, our good friend J. Edgar Hoover was very suspicious of this thing. He thought it was communism. He thought he was some sort of subversive. But King sort of made this left turn into Memphis when he heard about this garbage strike because it seemed like the perfect local indigenous expression of what he was trying to do in Washington. These were garbage workers, almost entirely African American workforce. Most of them were former sharecroppers from the Mississippi Delta, the poorest part of the United States. And it made perfect sense for him to go to Memphis and try to sort of represent their cause, even though his staff and the inner circle of the SCLC said, this is a trap, you don't want to do this, this is a mistake, we need to go to Washington, you're making a left turn into Memphis. But he said, no, we've got to do this. This is the perfect illustration of what we're trying to do up in Washington on a local scale. So he comes to Memphis and marches down Beale Street, which those of you who've been to Memphis know it's now become kind of the Bourbon Street of farther up the Delta. It's certainly overcrowded and overdone now, but it was the, you know, classic avenue of Black America for over a century. And I want to read a little passage from the book that has to do with the march that King led down Beale Street. It started off well, but things turned awry. It became clear that the march was taken over by some young radicals who had different ideas about nonviolence, who had different ideas about which way the civil rights movement should go. And because of that, because of this violence that breaks out and the looting and the rioting and the police sort of crack down on it. Because of that, King realizes he's got to come back to Memphis yet again to try to sort of redeem himself and his reputation and to prove to the nation that he can lead a nonviolent march. Okay, so this is March 28th. About a week or so before the assassination, and he and his inner circle, Abernathy, Lee, and a local minister named Lawson are marching down Beale Street, and things are starting to go awry. The march began. King, Abernathy, Lee, and Lawson locked arms in the front and began walking as police helicopters whirred overhead. They left Claiborne Temple and slogged along Hernando Street for a few blocks, jerking and halting, trying to find the right pace. Then they turned left onto Beale, the Avenue of the Blues, and marched west in the direction of the Mississippi River. In the rear, no one bothered to form orderly lines. The kids were jostling and shoving, sending forward wave after wave of people stumbling and stepping on heels. "Make the crowd stop pushing," King yelled. "We're going to be trampled." Soon they passed W.C. Handy Park, named for the prosperous bandleader and composer who first wrote down the blues and shaped the form into an internationally recognized genre. As it happened, this very day was the 10th anniversary of W.C. Handy's death, and someone had laid a wreath beside the bronze statue of the beaming bluesman standing with his trumpet at the ready. But this Beale was a faded version of the street that the father of the blues had known. Had he been alive to see it now, he would have despaired at its mirthless state. In Handy's heyday, it was the main street of Negro America, a place of deep soul and world-class foolishness, of zoot suits and chitlin joints, of hoodoos and fortune tellers, with jug bands playing on every corner. The street smelled of tamales and pulled pork and pot liquor and lard. Day and night, Beale throbbed with so much authentic and sometimes violent vitality that, as Handy put it in one of his famous songs, "Business never closes till somebody gets killed." For more than a century, blacks from all across the Mississippi Delta came to Beale to experience their first taste of city life. Workers came from the levee building camps, from the lumber and turpentine camps, from the cotton fields and the steamboat lines. The only confirmed studio photograph of Robert Johnson was taken on Beale, a ghostly image of the long-fingered bluesman posing in a fedora and a pinstripe suit with his well-worn guitar. Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and B.B. King came here to play some of their first city gigs. The South's first black millionaire, Robert Church, made his real estate fortune on Beale. Black doctors, black photographers, black dentists, black insurance companies, black mortuaries, black newspapers, hotels and restaurants for coloreds only, African-American parades as a counterpart to the all-white cotton carnival. Beale was a place where the concept of separate but equal had one of its more spirited and convincing runs. The Stax Records legend Rufus Thomas once quipped, "If you were black for one Saturday night on Beale, you'd never want to be white again." By the spring of 1968, however, most of the great clubs and theaters, the Daisy, the Palace, the Monarch, Pee Wee's Saloon, Club Handy, were boarded up or gone altogether. Though there were still reputable businesses closer to Maine, much of Beale had become a drab drag of busted concrete and liquor stores and pawn shops, populated by winos and petty thieves. As King tramped west on Beale, past Handy's statue, separate was most assuredly not equal. The blues was on its sickbed, it was said, a moribund music, an era dead and gone. Now a column of proud but anxious men carried signs in the direction of City Hall, headed for an uncertain future. So this is about a week before the assassination. What happens next, to skip ahead, is that a guy named James Earl Ray wanders into my hometown and changes history. I have some slides that begin to show some of the sort of evidence against James Earl Ray, and not so much against him as how the FBI and various law enforcement agencies caught him. It was a 65-day manhunt, and it took some 3,000 agents and many millions of dollars. It also took the law enforcement agencies of Canada and Mexico and Portugal, and finally Scotland Yard that caught him at Heathrow, where he was boarding a plane. He was trying to get to Rhodesia, where he wanted to become a mercenary soldier. This book is largely based on a collection in Memphis called the B. Vincent Hughes Collection. There was a cop in Memphis, Vince Hughes, who was the dispatcher on duty that night. And this event touched his life in a profound way and changed him forever, and he decided to devote his entire retirement to collecting and to digitizing all the documents he could get on the King assassination, some 20,000 documents and counting. I found out about Vince sort of by accident. There was a curator in Memphis who said, "There's this guy named Vince. You might want to talk to him. He's pretty cool. Here's his card." I said, "Well, some guy named Vince. That sounds really, very. That's not going to happen." I put that in my back pocket. But made several trips more to Memphis and finally found out that Vince was this amazing guy, this scholar and this gentleman who had been assembling all this stuff. And he's not, you know, pro-conspiracy or anti-conspiracy. He's pretty much right down the middle. His idea is to create the definitive sort of website open to the public on the King assassination. So most of these images come from the B. Vinson collection and begin to show kind of how the FBI put together this puzzle that ended up in James Earl Ray's capture. Okay, 1 second. There we go. Oh, this is a picture of Vince Hughes's police ID card. These are some pictures from the assassination itself. In the famous picture where Andy Young and the others are pointing towards this room house, the policemen come around to the back and onto South Main and come to this place, apartment rooms for rent. This is Bessie Brewer's rooming house on South Main. They go up the stairs, but before they do, they find that there's a bundle that's been left here in front of a jukebox amusement. It's called Kneipp's Amusement Store, where they service and sell jukeboxes. That bundle is there. They're not really sure what to make of it, but the policemen go up the stairs into this room where supposedly this person named John Willard had been staying in room 5B. What's noticeable about this photograph is that on the sofa and also on the floor, there is a strap, which they don't know what it is. They kind of put that on the back burner, but they later find out that it attaches to a pair of binoculars that had been purchased in Memphis. They notice that in room 5B, the window was open, the furniture had been moved from the window, and a chair was set in front of the window. Someone had been looking towards the Lorraine Motel. Obviously, the shot had not come from there, but it was kind of a nest for surveillance. The people in the flophouse said that the shot had come from a communal bathroom down the hall. And so they went down the hall. They found that the window was open and that the shot, the angle was a direct one from this communal bathroom. The screen had been pried loose from its groove there, and they found that just below. And that the shot had most likely been fired from someone standing in the bathtub. They found a handprint on the wall where if you were standing in the bathtub, you would need to kind of lean against the wall. And this is what that's the crime scene photo of the handprint that was raised with certain chemicals. So now they're trying to figure out, okay, what's this deal with this bundle? What's the story with that? Why would someone leave a bundle that has a gun, a scope, ammunition, and all kinds of other artifacts? But it became apparent why, as he was heading down this sidewalk towards the white Mustang that was spotted by numerous people, there was a cop car, as you can see right there, that was visible. And he realized, if he had this in his hands, he was caught with a murder weapon, so he had to get rid of it in a hurry, even though that seemed like a pretty stupid move. So he did, and the folks that were in the Kneipp Amusement Company saw the white Mustang head north on Main. They saw this bundle, and they began to sort of investigate, okay, what is in this bundle? They realized pretty quickly that everything that they needed to solve this case was in the bundle. These were some of the artifacts that were in this little suitcase that was twirled in a bedspread. A lot of toiletries, pair of binoculars, various other things, including Brill cream, and a newspaper from April 4th, that very day. In that article, King challenges court restraint. If you read the whole article and jump to the inside, it talks about how federal marshals had presented an injunction against King not to march on Beale Street in a follow-up march, and that the injunction had been presented at the Lorraine Motel. So it said right there in a front page article, King and his entourage were staying at the Lorraine. So it was public knowledge. It also mentioned, it showed a photograph with, in the background, if you look closely, you could see the room number, 306. So it was in the public record. They also found in the bundle these binoculars, which they realized had been just purchased 2 hours earlier at York Arms sporting goods store, with a receipt there. York Arms was the place where I bought my first, you know, baseball mitt. It was the basic sporting goods store in Santa Fe, in Memphis. I live in Santa Fe now, in Memphis, and this is where I bought my first mitt. They also found in this bundle a transistor radio, this channel master radio, which is significant only because on the housing of the radio they found a number which they weren't sure what to make of. It looked like it had been tampered with, but they kind of were able to decipher it, and it was 416. It was some sort of aftermarket number. They kind of set that aside, and we'll come back to that later, but it was one of the puzzles that they were trying to figure out early on. Also, a beer can that had been purchased in Mississippi a couple of days earlier that had a very good fingerprint on it. The gun, which was a .30-06, and going off the gun and the serial number on the gun, they were able to trace the weapon to this place, the Aero Marine sporting goods store in Birmingham, Alabama, where they found out that the gun had been purchased just 1 week earlier by a guy who called himself Harvey Lohmeyer. He had come in there trying to buy a slightly smaller weapon, weaker weapon, and then he came back the next day on March 29th saying, "No, actually, my brother says we're going hunting up in Wisconsin. We need a much more powerful weapon. We need a .30-06, and this is the weapon that he ended up purchasing. Also in the bundle was this, just some innocuous things like a tack hammer and a pair of pliers, which had a little identification tag on it that said Rompages, which led the FBI several thousand miles to the west, to Los Angeles, to this hardware store, Rompages, which said, yes, that they had sold that. So now they're kind of looking all over the country. They were looking in Memphis. They're now looking in Birmingham. Now they're looking in Los Angeles. Also in the bundle was this pair of undershorts, which is important really only because of a number right above the ruler there, 02B6, which was a laundry tag number that they found out through some inquiries was a kind of a new technology called the Thermoseal Tape Company out of Syracuse, New York, and also on a undershirt, 02B6. They said that most of their machines had been sold out in California, mostly in Los Angeles, so that led them to this laundry in Los Angeles. And they found out that, yes, indeed, a gentleman by the name of Eric Galt had been taking his laundry there once a week for several months before the assassination. So now they're looking for a guy named John Willard, but they're also looking for a guy named Harvey Lohmeyer, and now they're looking for a guy named Eric Galt, 02B6. The laundry had an address. This was the place where he was staying in Los Angeles shortly before the assassination. They found out that he, through the mails, that he had been writing letters from this address, and this was a letter that he wrote to a group called the Friends of Rhodesia, because he was trying to immigrate to Rhodesia, most likely because they did not have an extradition treaty with the United States. They also found out that this guy, Eric Galt, was into dancing. He took dancing lessons. He was particularly interested in the foxtrot and the cha-cha. And they began to get descriptions of this guy, Eric Galt, from various people who had danced with him and his various instructors. It was a place called the National Dance Studios. The folks there said, you know, he quit his dance lessons because he said he needed to save up money for a bartending school. Bartending school. So they start canvassing all the bartending schools in California and arrive at this place, the International School of Bartending. And There they find out that, yes, indeed, a guy named Eric S. Galt had taken some lessons. He had, during this course, memorized some 200 recipes for cocktails. And but they're wondering, well, what can you tell us about this guy? What did he look like? And the guy who ran this place, Tomas Reyes Lau, said, well, that's easy. Every graduate of our school is photographed with his diploma and a tuxedo. So we can show you what he looked like. This is what he looked like. So now we have a photograph of this guy, Eric Galt, except for one thing. His eyes are closed. They're not exactly sure what he looks like, but this is their first sort of tantalizing image of the guy that 3,000 FBI agents are now looking for. Also, they found out that Eric Galt, on March 18th, had put in a change of address form from his place in Los Angeles to Atlanta, Georgia, General Delivery, Atlanta, Georgia, and had moved there. Eric Galt had no connection to Atlanta, as far as we know. He had no friends there. But here he is moving to Martin Luther King's hometown. Okay, so they have a name now, Eric Galt. They're really trying to press this name. And they go to all the hotels and motels in the Memphis area and try to find out, did anyone named Eric Galt stay in Memphis around the time of the assassination? And sure enough, they find that this place, Vic Duprat's new Rebel Motor Hotel, just on the outskirts of Memphis, a guy named Eric Galt had stayed and checked in with a white Mustang on April 3rd, the night before the assassination. This is his registration card, and he's noting that he lives at 2608 Highland Avenue in Birmingham, Alabama. But notice that he mentions make of car, Mustang, and an Alabama license plate. Wait, let's go. Bear with me one second. Okay, so meanwhile, other FBI agents go out all over the South trying to find out any other Eric Galts, check into any other hotels. And they did find out that on March 22nd, an Eric Galt had checked into the Flamingo Motel on in Selma, Alabama, which was significant really only because they found out that very night, Martin Luther King had been scheduled to give a talk there. And it began to seem that he was sort of beginning to cross paths with Martin Luther King, whoever this Eric Galt was. They began to do a little more investigating. They found out that he had applied for a license in the state of Alabama, saying that he was a merchant marine, unemployed. They found out that he had stayed at this place on Highland. And yes, indeed, they remembered that an Eric Galt had lived there. While he was there, he had also sent off for some camera equipment, from a mail order company in Chicago. And they began to wonder what's up with all this camera equipment, but they later found out that Eric Galt had briefly dabbled with the idea of being a porn director, and that this was all just part of a scheme he had to get into the porn business. Meanwhile, other agents all over the South are trying to find this white Mustang, and it's 2 weeks after the assassination that they find it in Alabama. It's Eric Galt's white Mustang. They impound the vehicle. This is pictures of the car just hours after it's been impounded. They also found on the car that it has these Turista stickers, which indicated that whoever had been driving it had recently been in Mexico. So that kind of sends the search down to Mexico. Thousands of agents go all over Mexico trying to figure out, did someone named Eric Galt ever stay down there in the months leading up to the assassination? Sure enough, they found at the Hotel Rio and Puerto Vallarta this registration card for an Eric S. Galt, who called himself now a publisher employed. I'm not sure what that means. He's somehow in the publishing business now, but that he's again living at 2608 Highland Avenue. They found out that he had been frequenting prostitutes, and that one in particular had gotten to know him quite well, and she had taken a picture of him, and this is the picture that she had to offer. So now there's a second photograph of this Eric Galt. His eyes may or may not be shut there, but again, they're beginning at least to get some images to work with. Okay, separate from all of this, there's a group of fingerprint analysts in Washington, D.C., who are comparing the fingerprints taken from the beer can and from the stock of the rifle and various other artifacts in the bundle, comparing them piece by piece, one by one, with the fingerprints of every known fugitive in the United States, a process that would take possibly months. They get a direct match several weeks into the process with an escaped fugitive from Missouri named James Earl Ray. So now, you know, they're realizing they're not looking for a John Willard, a Harvey Lohmeyer, or an Eric Galt. They're looking for one guy, and his real name is James Earl Ray. So they go back, and they find a lot of sort of images of his criminal past. They learned a little bit about his biography. And then they pause for a moment because they see this number, 416, and they suddenly realize that the number on the radio makes sense. That this was a radio that he had purchased in prison the day before he escaped from a maximum security prison in Missouri. And it was as was required by the prison rules, you had to have this number stamped in sort of an indelible stamp on the housing that showed your prison ID number. So that's what the 416 was about. But by this point, Ray was gone. He was in Canada, living in this rooming house in Toronto and working on getting a new alias for himself. People say, well, you know, he must have been really sophisticated, part of some shadowy international conspiracy to get these IDs. But in Canada, the expression was, welcome to Canada. We trust you. All you really had to do was what he did here. He went to the back issues of the newspaper, found the birth notices of people born in his birth year, and based on the very scant information he got there, he applied to the Registrar of Births and got a duplicate birth certificate, in this case in the name of Ramon George Snade. They gave it to him straight away. On the basis of that, that was all that was required, was this duplicate to get a passport in the name of Ramon George Snade. So now he has a passport. He gets an air ticket to London because by this point it's been well publicized that they're looking for James Earl Ray. He knows he's got to get out of North America. And unclear exactly where he gets the money, but he talks about robbing a grocery store. He talks about various other stick-ups that he may or may not have done. Somehow he scrapes the money to get at least to London. This is his ticket from Toronto to London. He then goes immediately to Portugal. To get to Portugal, he wants to, you know, the idea is he wants to hook up with these mercenary groups, get on a ship to go to Angola. And the problem is he doesn't speak the language. He doesn't know the culture. He's lost there. He's running out of ideas. So he goes back from Lisbon to London. And now he's really running out of ideas. He robs a jewelry store. He robs a bank. He is trying to get to Johannesburg or to Salisbury, Rhodesia. And when they found him at Heathrow, he had this on his person, which was a timetable of airplanes to South Africa. They also found this book, which is sort of an overview guide to Rhodesia. They also found a loaded revolver, which he had in his pocket. I guess times were very different back then. You could board a plane and, you know, with a loaded revolver and no problem. In fact, when they caught him, they didn't really make too big a stink about it. They just wanted to know if he had a permit for his gun. And they asked him, why do you need a gun? What's your story? And he said, well, you know, I'm going to Rhodesia and things are really difficult down there. And they basically accepted his story. But, you know, they said, you know, we've compared your fingerprints, and they actually compared the fingerprints with those of James Earl Ray, and they finally said, you know, you're James Earl Ray. He vociferously and vehemently denied that he was Ray. No, I'm Ramon Snade. They got me mixed up with this other guy named James Earl Ray. I don't know who this guy is. His lawyer, his solicitor in London said that, you know, look, you're going to be here for a while. How can I help you? I know you're not James Earl. You say you're Snade. And he says, yes, I'm Snade. They got me mixed up with this guy, but I would really appreciate it if you could get in contact with my brother. Well, sure. Who's your brother? How can I help? What's his name? Jerry Ray. Not realizing that his various identities had sort of bled into each other at that point. He insisted for a month or more that he was Snade. He called himself Sir Ramon Snade. Finally, he loses his extradition hearing, and he's flown back to Memphis aboard a chartered Air Force jet, where he stands trial and is about to go to trial when he plea bargains and admits to some 150 points of fact, saying that he did pull the trigger, and yes, he bought the scope and the ammunition and all this evidence that I've been showing you tonight. Yes, that was my getaway car that you saw me in. And so he was given a life sentence. Only 3 days later, he recanted part of his testimony, saying, well, all that stuff is true, except for one thing. I didn't pull the trigger. There was this mysterious guy named Raul who pulled the trigger, and which opened up an eternal cataract of conspiracy theories and, you know, different ideas about who is this Raul guy. But Ray spent the rest of his life in prison, except for one little moment. I don't want to give away too much of the end of the book, but he does break out one more time from another maximum security prison, this time in Tennessee, fairly ingeniously. He's out in the Cumberland Mountains for 3 days until he's finally caught by bloodhounds. The Lorraine Motel, which is, you know, was a great source of embarrassment to Memphis. Most of Memphis wanted to get rid of it. They were embarrassed and ashamed and mortified by this place. But some very forward-thinking leaders of Memphis, black and white, got together and said, this is part of our history. This is important that we honor this place. It has become the National Civil Rights Museum and is a probably the most frequented place after Graceland in Memphis. And is a beautiful place and is sort of place where people come to try to reckon with history, try to figure out what happened here, was there a conspiracy, was there not a conspiracy, try to figure out the different sight lines and go to the flop house, which is now also part of the museum, to try to figure out what exactly happened. So I would like to hear from you, any questions that you might have about this project and how I researched it and how all these different things come together. Now, I don't know if it was mentioned, but Book TV is here with us tonight. They're taping this. So any questions that you do have, if you can make sure that you speak to the microphone and that you're clearly heard, not just for my benefit, but for everyone here in the audience and for the television audience. And I do want to welcome the audience from Book TV look forward to hearing from you. Front and center.
Yes, you indicated his means of income was probably thievery, robbing banks, and so on and so forth. Were there other means of income? Was he receiving monies from other persons?
Well, I think the question of Ray's income is probably the central question of the whole case and of his fugitive wanderings, because the guy got around, clearly. And I looked into it as much as I possibly could. He says that he was involved in smuggling schemes and fencing schemes. He told one journalist that he sold a bunch of pot and other drugs. He had been, while in prison, a merchant of amphetamines and saved up some money. The FBI believed that he and his brothers robbed a bank in Alton, Illinois, about 2 months after he escaped from that Missouri prison, that netted $30,000. Anything else is guesswork, but, you know, I think it's possible that he hooked up with some bounty on King's life. He certainly knew about some of them. whether he got paid in full, I highly doubt, because he wouldn't have tried to rob this grocery store in Toronto and robbed the jewelry store in London and finally robbed this bank in London and it thus expose himself in this way if he had been part of a well-oiled and well-funded, conspiracy. He, on the other side of the ledger, you have to realize he lived really, really frugally, except for a few things like the dancing lessons and the $250 nose job that he got a month before the assassination. He was living in these god-awful flop houses. He was mostly eating in his room, you know, with an immersion heater and these sort of you know, dried soups and powdered foods like that. So, you know, he wasn't living high on the hog, let's put it that way. But it's a good question, and I don't have all the answers. I mean, I leave a lot of doors open in this narrative about where the sources of money might have come from. I think that his brothers were certainly aiding and abetting him and perhaps funneling money to him. But it's so many steps along the way, you see an element of desperation where, you know, the old James Earl Ray, the old petty criminal, is coming to the fore, where he's doing rash things and stupid things, desperate things to get, you know, finally get to Canada and then finally get to London. It doesn't feel like a super sophisticated conspiracy to me, at least. Thanks for your question, though. Yes, sir, in the very middle of the room. Hold on one sec.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library, and thank you for your earlier books, particularly Blood and Thunder, which
thank
I very
you.
Much enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk a bit about how he was picked up at the airport in England? Did someone recognize him for the robbery there, or had his pictures been circulated so that he was identified as James Earl Ray, the American killer?
Well, you want me to give away the book, don't you? I can tell you this. They figured out that he had gone to Toronto to get aliases, and so they basically, the FBI asked the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to examine every passport application that had been received after the assassination, and to sort of single out every photo that looked even remotely like James Earl Ray. And there was a lowly constable, I think he was like 21 years old, who found this passport photo and said, you know, that could be James Earl Ray. It looks sort of like him. I'll put him in the possibles pile. This is the picture that he saw. You know, he's like, if James Earl Ray had glasses and, you know, it's hard to say. They put him in the possibles pile and found out that there was a real guy named Ramon Snade. And they interviewed him, and they found out that he had never in his life applied for a passport. So they figured out this is a fraud. Okay, so we got a fraudulent passport. And so they called all the travel agents in Toronto and found out that a guy named Ramon Snade had gone to London. So they called Scotland Yard and had Scotland Yard put a what's called an all-ports warning on this guy, Ramon Snade. So basically the person who stopped him was a customs officer who had no idea he was wanted for the killing of Martin Luther King. All he knew was that the passport was fraudulent and he was to be detained and questioned. So that's the short answer. You know, there's actually some more complexities to it. But he's detained and questioned, and the guy, of course, who questions him asks him, are you James Earl Ray? And he says, no, I'm Ramon Snade. What kind of name is that anyway? Ramon Snade. But he stuck by that story for about a month and a half until he finally admitted in Memphis that he was James Earl Ray. Yes, sir, right here.
Other than the drama of chasing this man down halfway across the world, what about the personality? Did you study and did you talk about the psychology of this man? What, since it wasn't a conspiracy based on philosophical and racist reasons directly, well, why was this guy so committed to, you know, that would be kind of an interesting approach.
Well, I certainly stewed over it and worried about it and wondered about it because, you know, you kind of inhabit this guy's world for 3 years. You wonder who he really is. And it's not as satisfying as I'd like it to be. I'd like there to be this magical epiphany where I understood him. But I think that all of us look for some sort of rational explanation for what is fundamentally an irrational, insane act of violence. I think what you really get with Ray is not so much a single motivation as a cluster of sub-motivations. He had some mental illness, which was accentuated by years of amphetamine use. He was a racist. While he was in prison, he talked to fellow inmates about how Martin Luther Coon was going to, as he called him, was going to be his retirement plan. He examined the Kennedy assassination and talked about the mistakes that Oswald had made and how he would improve upon them and not make those mistakes. You know, he was a racist, but, you know, is that enough by itself to explain him? No. I mean, yeah, he wanted to immigrate to Rhodesia. Yeah, he was a big George Wallace fan and was volunteering for the George Wallace campaign of 1968. He was a John Bircher. He was, a reactionary kind of in his political views. But that's not, to me, enough to explain him. I think the biggest explanation was really his unhappiness and his sort of desperation in the months leading up to the assassination, where you see that he's just reaching out desperately to find something, some sort of meaning, some sort of purpose in his life. He's doing the bartending school, the dancing lessons. He goes and takes a locksmithing course. He gets the nose job. He gets into self-hypnosis, goes to a bunch of shrinks. And then he starts reading these various self-help books, one in particular that was found on his person when he was caught in London, called Psycho-Cybernetics, which talked endlessly. And I read this book. I dare you guys to read it. It's horrific reading. But the purpose of the book is really to show, basically it says to find meaning in life, you have to have a goal to aim for and to shoot at. And it talks about a person being a torpedo. It talks about a person being a bullet. It talks about a person being, this sort of goal-seeking mechanism. And I do believe on a profound level, and I'm not a shrink, and I don't entertain any kind of pop psychology here, but, I do show this book, and I show what it says, and how influential it clearly was in his life. And you sort of mix all these sub-motivations together, and you begin to get a sense of James Earl Ray. But he's very mysterious. He's very enigmatic. He's a lost soul. And I think, like so many assassins throughout American history, it isn't this magical explanation. Oh, I did it for this reason. He did it because he screwed up. He did it because he's lost. He did it because he is taking literally some of the chatter that he's hearing out there in the airwaves from people like Wallace. I should go kill Martin Luther King. And add to that, within the lore of the Ray family, he was supposedly the ambitious one. He was the one that was really going to do big things. He was a hustler, a businessman, and I don't know about this family. I mean, sort of like Daryl and my other brother Daryl. It's like not exactly a family that you associate with ambition, but within that family, he was the one that was going to do the big things. So those are some of the ways I've come to think about why he did it. But it is fundamentally an unanswerable question, I think. Yes, sir.
If he is or was, as you describe him, why wouldn't he have boasted about having killed King? I am the one who killed this man. Wouldn't that satisfy the character you just described?
You'd think. I would. He did boast to some people. He was married briefly to a woman. There's always in prison like some woman who gravitates towards someone on death row. I don't know how that happens, but she married him and she was in love with him and they had some conjugal visits, and then about a year later he confessed to her, yeah, I killed the son of a bitch, what of it? And she divorced him, and he boasted to several other people that he had done it, but he also was a savvy kind of stirwise character. He understood the way the law works, and he loved the chase. I believe that he loved being, orchestrating this big chase that went on for 65 days, and essentially he spent the rest of his time orchestrating a legal chase. He loved sending out these mixed signals and confounding people. There was a prison shrink, who said he had the duping delight. This idea of like where he was most happy was when he was confusing people and baffling people, who were trying to help him, like his own lawyers. One of his lawyers told me in Birmingham that you could always tell, the only time you could tell when Ray was telling the truth, when he was lying, was when his lips were moving. And that's, it's so true. I mean, he sent out these signals throughout his whole career. I describe him as a kind of like a squid who squirts out this cloud, you're trying to figure out what is he saying? Is he lying? Is he telling the truth? Is there some part of what he's saying that's true? And by the time you think you've got an answer, he's changed. He's gone. He's changed his name, his location. He's changed his story. He was a pathological liar. He went to his grave with secrets, and I think in some ways he's chuckling now because people like me and others are trying to figure out what was he up to. You'd think he would have boasted to a lot more people than just some inner circle of his. But in the end, no. I think the confusion that he put out into the world was really what animated him and excited him and explains, as much as we can understand him, his persona. In the middle there.
It seems like as much as J. Edgar Hoover despised Martin Luther King, after the assassination, he was very, very committed to catch the assassin. That he did not, it was almost an affront to Hoover that if anybody was going to destroy King, it was going to be him. Could you speak to that for briefly,
yeah,
please? Thank you.
Yeah. Well, he, you know, Hoover hated King. There's no question about that. He and his field agents had done everything they could possibly do to ruin him and smear him and sabotage the movement and eavesdrop and bug and, you know, all that stuff is absolutely true. And you could write a whole book just on that subject of why King upset him so much and, infuriated him so much. But once this assassination happened, the FBI was under such an enormous amount of pressure to solve this case. Pressure coming from Lyndon Johnson, pressure coming especially from Ramsey Clark, the Attorney General of the United States, who was, you know, a huge admirer of King and who was Hoover's boss, although some people say Hoover didn't really have a boss. You have to remember that there were over 150 different riots going on around the country. I mean, this manhunt was going on against a nation on fire, essentially. And people had to, people had to realize no matter what the political persuasions might be of some of the individual field agents out there, that solving this crime was of paramount national importance. Hoover did not want to get involved at first. He wanted this to be a local case, Memphis Police Department, Tennessee, authorities. But it became clear this was in an international case, that the assassin had fled to another state, maybe another country. This was the biggest assassination that had happened in the country since Kennedy. So in the end, there was really no question. And once the FBI gets involved in the job that they're supposed to be doing, namely solving crimes and doing police work and detective work, I found out, they really did do their job. I mean, they... the level of police work, the level of sort of shoe leather that was expended, the man hours, the thousands and thousands of false leads that were pursued, in addition to the ones that panned out, the number of agents, the number of miles, it was the largest manhunt in American history up to that point. And there's no question in my mind that the FBI did their job. And, it was exciting in a way to see them actually doing this instead of trying to ruin King and trying to ruin his movement. They're actually trying, and in an ironic way, that Hoover's very, this very agency that hated King was responsible for finding his killer. In the end, it was a great source of embarrassment to Hoover that they didn't find him, that it was Scotland Yard that got him. He didn't like to give Scotland Yard any credit for it, but that's Hoover for you. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. To what extent was this a well-thought-out plan versus, I get a sense from what you're talking from your presentation, that he went out and bought the gun just a few days beforehand, went to buy the binoculars a few hours beforehand. It seems like, geez, I don't know what to do tonight. Maybe I'll go see a movie, or maybe I'll go assassinate Dr. King.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is an element of that. I mean, he reads a lot. He plans a lot. He's capable of great and methodical kind of cunning plotting, as in breaking out of a maximum security prison. But he's also highly susceptible to, like, the local news and what's going on. And, so that makes me think that when he got to Atlanta, he got this flop house. He bought some maps of Atlanta, maps that were later found and entered into evidence that show that he had circled King's house, King's church, King's office. He was plotting King's world, but he was frustrated because King was never at home. King was always traveling, especially now because he was drumming up support for his poor people's campaign. So I think he became very frustrated that, you know, how am I going to, if I'm going to do this, I've got to have some kind of, I got to intersect in some way that's, you know, going to be, you know, obvious. The local papers, the Atlanta Constitution, reported that King was going back to Memphis after this violent march that happened. He had to go back and redeem himself and do this second march down Beale. And it announced when the march was likely going to be and when he was going back to Memphis and who would be there. And so it gave him some time to think and plan and, you know, begin to think, you know, how do I intersect with this guy? Once he got to Memphis, there it was, page one of the Memphis Commercial Appeal. He's there at the Lorraine Motel. So I do think there's an erratic nature to his movements, and he's planning in a kind of a long-term sense, but he's also very much influenced by his immediate, the news that's coming in over his radio, the news that's coming in over his portable television, and the news that he's reading from the papers. He was a news junkie. He was constantly reading the papers, and that's where he got his ideas. But, you know, just sort of like going to Rhodesia, I'm sure he read all about Rhodesia in the papers, but he didn't connect the dots very well. He, you know, had this idea he'd just go over there, they would embrace him, he would hook up with these guys, but the, you know, whatever horrible racists they might have been over there, they were actually professionals. They weren't going to just embrace this stranger from America. And he never was able to connect those dots very well, things like that. But thanks for your question. Yeah, I think we have time for at least one more question. Anybody else? Yes, sir, right here.
In his last days, he admitted to Martin Luther King's sons that he did not assassinate King. What are your views about that last statement?
Well, shortly before he died, Dexter King had come to meet with him, and he asked him, "Did you kill my dad?" And he said, "No, I didn't." And that's the story that sort of made the wires. But right after that, he said, "But you see, it's complicated. These things are very complicated." And that was the asterisk that wasn't reported. And that was classic Ray. Everything had a sort of asterisk. If he didn't kill King, why did he say that? If he did kill King, why did he plea bargain and said he did and then later recant 3 days later and say, well, this guy named Raul actually did it? That's just classic Ray. He nothing was clear. That's the squid ink that I'm talking about. I think that the King family very understandably wanted a real trial because there was never a trial. There was a plea bargain. And so, you know, the evidence was presented, but not in, you know, open adversarial way that you would hope from a criminal proceeding. So understandably, that's what they wanted. And I think that some members of the King family were convinced that Ray was innocent, or at least that he was part of a larger conspiracy. And in a way, I'm convinced that he was part of a cruder conspiracy, but a conspiracy of more than one person, for sure. But, you know, whether the King family found comfort in that or closure in that, it's really hard for me to know. But to me, it was kind of a testament to Ray's cunning, a kind of final testament to his cunning, that he was able to convince people that this guy Raul existed when we've never seen a photograph, we've never seen an address, we don't know what he looked like, there's never been a witness who's ever seen this guy Raul in the same room with Ray. And that was, you know, the fact that that was enough for members of the inner circle and for certain members of the King family shows, I think, the element of conspiracy. You know, we all kind of, it's human nature to believe in conspiracy, to look for these larger patterns in a huge crime like this. And so I don't know what to make of it in the end. It's disturbing to me because no matter where you stand on the conspiracy question, there's absolutely no question that Ray was there. He admitted that he was there. He, to the day he died, said he bought the weapon, he bought the scope, He was there at that crime scene. You're kind of stuck with James Earl Ray being there. And yet, you know, a member of the King family shook his hand and said, I believe you. You didn't do it. You had nothing to do with this. It's disturbing to me. But, you know, why they did that, that's their question. That's their business. And I think it has a lot to do with wanting that airing of a new trial that would have come if it had been possible. But by that point, Ray was dying of liver disease. There was a movement to try to get him a new liver. He was way down on the list because, you know, he was a convicted criminal. And I think that, you know, maybe members of the King family thought if they could just get him a liver transplant, it would be possible to get him back on trial and really finally hear what he had to say, because I think in the end, that's the frustration. The most frustrating thing about this guy, Ray, was that he went to his grave, as the King family knows, and everyone knows, I think, with a lot of secrets. Secrets that, you know, we may never have all the answers to. Thanks for your question, and thank you so much for listening tonight.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.